Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
You know, it's very, very quiet at the public boat landing, almost eerily quiet.
Subsistence Chinook and chum salmon fishing on the Yukon River will likely stay closed through the end of the season. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, thunderstorms and dry weather keep Alaska's fire season raging.
I mean, here in Fairbanks, we've only had a half inch of rain this summer. It's way below what we would normally have.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Over 1,000 firefighters are working in Alaska as the state continues to experience an intense season with more than 225 active fires. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
There were 4,500 lightning strikes in Alaska Tuesday, the latest in a run of days with thousands of ground strikes. There are also another 13 new primarily lightning-sparked wildfires in the state Tuesday, mostly in the interior. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says the abundant lightning is the product of high pressure over northwestern Canada and low pressure in the Bering Sea.
And we've seen a series of upper-level low-pressure troughs that have moved from southeast to northwest across the state over the last 4 or 5 days. And each of those has caused thunderstorms.
Brader adds that the thunderstorms are occurring outside their normal daily time frame.
With those low pressure troughs, because they provide enough lift, it's not just the usual sun heats up the earth and causes rising motion that causes a thunderstorm. These type of features cause a mechanical lift that can cause thunderstorms to go through the night, and that's been happening the last 4 or 5 nights where we've had thunderstorms somewhere in the state going all through the night till 7 or 8 in the morning.
Nearly 30,000 lightning strikes were detected in Alaska between June 28th and July 5th, and Brader emphasizes that the ground strikes have coincided with very dry conditions.
I mean, here in Fairbanks, we've only had a half inch of rain this summer. It's way below what we would normally have, of like 1.6 inches.
Brader says wildfires in southwest Alaska are forecast to get some rain, but not enough to put them out, while the interior is expected to remain in a warm, relatively dry pattern with some thunderstorms through the weekend. Conditions vary daily on the many fires burning across the state. Minto Lakes Fire Information Officer Kristen Allison reported Tuesday less fire activity on the 32,000-acre blaze north of Fairbanks along the Chattanooga River.
We've been sitting under a high-pressure system, and really what it's done for us, it moderated our fire growth.
Allison says crews continue to work along the river doing structure protection on over 60 cabins.
They're putting in hoses, pumps, and sprinklers, and actually doing limbing around houses.
Allison says that work is about 75% complete. Meanwhile, other crews are working on the fire's eastern edge where it could threaten the Himalaya and Hayes Creek subdivisions. Allison says they're reopening lines built during the 2011 Hastings fire.
To try to connect that all the way down to the river, in effect, cutting it off from the values at risk towards the east, the homes there, the Elliott Highway, and the pipeline.
Allison says the team managing the Minto Lakes fire response will host a community meeting Thursday night. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Subsistence salmon fishing for Yukon River Chinook and summer chum salmon will likely remain closed through the end of the season. It's a possibility that fishery managers had warned could happen ever since before the season began. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Expecting low returns, fishery managers said they would keep subsistence salmon fishing closed through the midpoint of the Chinook and summer chum runs. Now, both those midpoints have passed the lower river, and neither indicate there will be enough fish to meet the goals managers set for fish to escape to their spawning grounds. Dina Jalen is a state fishery manager for the Yukon River.
And so unless these runs are exceptionally, kind of abnormally, extremely late, it's unlikely that we'll get enough fish coming in the last part of the season.
That possibility is near impossible. Only about 20% of the average amount of Chinook and summer chum have returned to the lower river. It's the lowest Chinook run ever, and the second lowest summer chum run, just barely more than what returned last year. Again, manager Dina Jalen.
So we know that that's, you know, incredibly disappointing. It's really hard to see these runs come back so low. It's hard to have fishing be closed. But that's unfortunately what we have to do when the runs are this small.
It's very, very quiet at the public boat landing in town, almost eerily quiet.
Yukon River residents called into a weekly salmon teleconference on Tuesday. The calls are hosted by the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. A caller who identified herself as Ruby and Eagle said she simply couldn't provide a subsistence report since no one has been fishing. The community is facing other challenges too.
Very dry, very hot, lots of smoke. We haven't had any measurable rain for a really long time, what seems like probably a month.
Downriver, in Russian Mission, a caller who identified herself as Olga said an elder has been asking her for a taste of fish.
And then I told her that it's not us that's saying they can't fish. It's just a regulation from way up high. And then she practically was crying and say, well, tell those people not to go shop for 4 weeks in their store. They have it easy to go to the store to get what they want to eat.
In some good news, pink salmon counts are picking up in the lower river. Subsistence users can target pink and red salmon with 4-inch mesh set nets along with other gear types. Holly Carroll is a federal fishery manager for the Yukon River. She asked fishermen to move their nets if they're catching a lot of summer chum or chinook. She said it's important each makes it to their spawning grounds.
We have had years like this before, certainly for chum in 2000, 2001, and we recovered. And I have faith that we can recover again and we'll be fishing that species again, but just not this year.
She also referenced the moratorium in 2013 and 2014 prohibiting all Chinook harvest and the rebound that followed.
So while it may be hard right now, I'm just trying to put out a message for hope that if we let these fish go by now, we will be fishing on them again in 5 years' time, 4 years' time for the chum. That's my hope. Maybe even less for the chum. Maybe 2 or 3 years we could see these runs rebound.
In the meantime, salmon fishing remains closed on the Yukon River. For KYUK, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
4 bears have been killed at an Anchorage campground recently opened to homeless campers after the bears entered tents to get food and other items. Anchorage police reported the problem bears, a sow black bear with 2 cubs and a separate male black bear, and 2 state biologists killed them Tuesday, according to the State Department of Fish and Game. In late June, the administration of Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson abruptly canceled pre-existing reservations at Centennial Campground and opened it to city residents who'd been living outside, including some who'd been staying at a camp the city cleared out. The city also bused dozens of people to the campground last week when it closed the shelter at Sullivan Arena. Within days, there were reports of bears getting into tents at the campground, which is northeast of Anchorage's downtown core and sits adjacent to large areas of wooded military and state parkland. Centennial Campground has had human-bear conflicts in the past, said Cindy Wardlow, South Central Regional Supervisor of the Division of Wildlife Conservation.
So we always expect that there will be bears potentially going through there.
Wardlow said the Department of Fish and Game got little warning about the plan to allow homeless residents to camp at Centennial Campground and found out at the same time as the general public.
It was a surprise for us at the agency. We try to work closely with the municipality and with APD, especially if there's a situation that could create a public safety concern. and we're looking for ways to help them come up with solutions any way that we can to keep people safe.
Mike Braniff, the city's Parks and Trails General Safety Foreman, who has been appointed to lead the city's Parks Department, says the city purchased and distributed bear-resistant food containers to campers at Centennial Campground. And he says staff are also looking for food that's left out and trying to educate campers about bear safety. Braniff says there are more than 200 people estimated to have been staying at Centennial Campground recently. In a written statement, Corey Allen Young, a spokesperson for Mayor Bronson, said, quote, "The Centennial Campground is being used as an option for people who choose to utilize it during fire danger periods. Centennial Campground will continue to be used as a legal camping option in the municipality for individuals who choose to camp," end quote. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at the future of oil and gas leases in Cook Inlet.
It's frustrating sometimes to weigh in again and again and feel like you're not being heard, but I think the administration did hear people last time and do want to hear from people again.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Ketchikan City Council is scheduled to consider banning so-called conversion therapy that aims to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. Council members plan to discuss Thursday whether to draft an ordinance banning the practice for minors within city limits. City Council member Jenna Lee Gage sponsored the proposal.
We're talking about a practice that's been discredited that targets LGBTQ plus youth and seeks to change their sexual orientation or gender identity. This practice has been rejected by every mainstream medical and mental health organization for decades.
Leading medical organizations like the American Medical Association and American Psychological Association reject conversion therapy, saying it puts children at risk of suicide. Ketchikan Pride Alliance board member Ryan McHale said in a prepared statement that the practice is dangerous.
Conversion therapy has repeatedly been linked to an increase in the likelihood of anxiety, depression, substance abuse, homelessness, and suicide. The Ketchikan Pride Alliance encourages discussion on this issue. It is our hope that Ketchikan can be a community that is safe and inclusive to all.
Gage says the ordinance would only apply to state-licensed physicians, therapists, psychologists, and other medical professionals. She says conversion therapy led by clergy would still be allowed. It's unclear how widespread conversion therapy is in Ketchikan. Gage says concerned residents have reached out to her about ongoing conversion therapy efforts involving Ketchikan youth. She declined to name the providers involved, citing privacy concerns. She did not name any medical professionals who might be affected by the ban. A spokesperson for Peace Health Ketchikan Medical Center, the local hospital and largest medical provider, said in an email that conversion therapy is not something practiced nor supported by the Catholic hospital system. The proposed ban comes on the heels of intense community debates over Pride Month programming at Ketchikan's library and government funding for the Pride Alliance. Gage says she's expecting more pushback.
I am expecting that, probably because I always expect the worst.
The ban would need a 4-vote majority to move forward. If approved Thursday, a draft ordinance would be brought back for another vote at a later date. Governor Mike Dunleavy's vetoes to the state budget last week included slashing roughly $10.5 million in funding for the Alaska Long Trail project. The project would span roughly 500 miles and connect Seward to Fairbanks via what's called a braided trail, mixing a series of walkable paths as well as paths accessible by four-wheelers and snow machines. Mariam Medavaya works with Alaska Trails, a nonprofit trail-building group that's been spearheading the project for about a year and a half. She says her group put a proposal to the legislature for roughly $14 million that would fund 15 projects along the main trail route. She says 7 of those projects, totaling about $4 million, survived the governor's vetoes. The funds will go to several Anchorage land managers.
They will include a lot of trail improvements, trail construction, some planning money for connections between Anchorage and Matsuboro.
The projects that were vetoed were outside Anchorage and included pieces of the trail in the Matsu, Denali, and Fairbanks North Star boroughs. In a statement, Dunleavy spokesman Jeff Turner said the governor felt many Alaskans had little information about the project. Turner wrote, quote, "The governor decided to veto some of the funding so discussions can take place this year about the trail's potential impacts and benefits for Alaska's tourism industry," end quote. Medevaya says she understands the governor's hesitation and fiscal reasoning for the cuts. She says she remains optimistic since almost half of the Alaska Long Trail projects remained in the budget.
And we already see a lot of support and momentum from many bipartisan entities, organizations, agencies across the state. But that said, there's still a lot of people don't know about it, and there's still a lot of hesitation and some concerns and fears of losing access.
Medevaya says Alaska Trails looks forward to working with the state over the next year to get the remaining projects funded in the next budget. Well, there won't be an oil and gas lease sale in Cook Inlet this year or the year after that. An Obama-era proposal to hold a sale in the inlet was canceled this year due to a cited lack of industry interest. But the Biden administration may offer another sale down the line. In a new proposed five-year plan for offshore drilling released Friday, the Department of the Interior floated the idea of auctioning off leases to oil and gas companies in the inlet in 2026. That's in addition to 10 lease sales proposed for the Gulf of Mexico. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Liz Mehring is with Cook Inlet Keeper. The Homer nonprofit helped get thousands of comments submitted in opposition to the sale last time.
And it's frustrating sometimes to weigh in again and again and feel like you're not being heard. But I think the administration did hear people last time and do want to hear from people again.
The Department of the Interior issues a new oil and gas leasing plan every 5 years for federal waters. That includes anything that's more than 3 nautical miles off the coast of the U.S. The current plan from the Obama administration expires this summer. It also called for a lease sale in Cook Inlet, but that sale never happened. The Fed said they didn't hear enough interest from the oil and gas industry to go forward with the plan. In the new 500-page draft, the department said holding no more than one lease sale in Cook Inlet would allow for activity from the oil and gas industry as well as other industries like fishing and tourism. The plan is just a proposal, and even with a lease sale on the books, the feds could still change their minds. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which oversees the offshore leasing program, canceled sales in 2006, 2008, and 2010 in the inlet, also citing lack of industry interest. Kara Moriarty is president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. She says it's hard to tell whether a lease sale will actually pan out this time.
There are a lot of factors that go into whether companies bid and when they bid and how much they bid. And, you know, that's just something they keep pretty close to the chest because they don't want to tip off any competitors.
She says it will depend in part on what the market conditions are several years down the line. Still, she says she's glad the door is open for a sale, even if it's all very hypothetical. The plan does not include any potential lease sales in the Arctic, something that did make it into a proposed plan from the Trump administration, but was later shot down in court.
I guess one is better than none. And if there's no interest, there's no interest. I mean, there's no harm, no foul if the federal or state government offer a lease sale. And if nobody shows, then oh well.
The Department of the Interior will open up comments on the plan Friday, which will be the start of a 90-day comment period. The department's also holding virtual meetings to get input on the proposed plan next month. Mehring, with Inlet Keeper, hopes that will be a chance to stop a lease sale from going through before it even starts.
Certainly, Cook Inlet Keeper will be asking people to again weigh in and making sure that the Biden administration is very clear on what the people in Cook Inlet want and, you know, into protecting sustainable local economies and fishing and tourism and a way of life here.
She notes it won't be the last time for public comment on a sale. If feds do ultimately decide to hold a lease sale in Cook Inlet in the next few years, there will be additional chances for comment. But that likely wouldn't be until 2025 or later. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
One of the state's largest COVID testing providers reopened two sites in South Central yesterday due to public demand. One is in South Anchorage and one is in Wasilla. Capstone had closed testing sites throughout the state on June 30th, saying they were no longer financially viable. But Matt Jones, Capstone's director of non-clinical operations, says Capstone doctors and members of the public wanted sites to stay open.
We could condense down the number of sites we have, reduce the hours, and limit the offerings, and we could still provide testing for the public rather than just doing it for our own patients in our clinics.
Federal funding to test uninsured people for COVID-19 ran out on March 22nd. Capstone will now charge uninsured patients $85 for tests. Jones estimates 60 to 70 people got tested at the sites yesterday. He says if demand drops much further, Capstone may close the two sites for good.
If the testing volume it doesn't pan out, I really don't know how long we could keep it open. I'm just going to give it a couple of weeks and see how it's going, and then it will be something that we are continually monitoring.
The Capstone sites are open from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services was the largest state agency, but as of July 1st, it has split into two smaller departments. State officials say the new structure will make the agencies easier to handle. Adam Crum ran the combined agency. Now he's the commissioner of the new health department.
Alaska should not notice that any change has occurred. Our websites are updated, but services that Alaskans receive should not see any changes.
The Department of Health will take care of health care services, public health, behavioral health, senior and disability services, and Medicaid. The other new department is called Family and Community Services. It will support the child welfare system and other direct services like Alaska Psychiatric Institute and state-operated assisted living homes. Marianne Sweet is its assistant commissioner. She said the split will mean each department is more efficient.
We're going to be able to have a more central focus on the programs that we're supporting within our department support services.
Crum said department leaders have cleared their schedules this week to make sure the transition is smooth and to respond to questions. Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka is undergoing a leadership shift this summer. A new superintendent was hired to take over the state-run boarding school, and she is no stranger to the campus or to its mission of combining a rigorous academic education with deeply held cultural traditions. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
My name is Suzuk. I am from Gigaktak or Shishmaref. Sitka mi inu neaktunga pagmami. I live in Sitka right now.
Suzuk Huntington sits at the end of a long conference table, sunlight streaming into the windows of her new corner office. From here, she can see both the Sitka skyline and students as they walk to class each morning when classes resume at Mount Edgecombe this fall.
The shrubbery right outside, which I just love, at that close proximity to it, I couldn't see above it, so there is one exact spot that is precisely where my chair is that allows me to see.
She's still unpacking, but she says the first thing that went on the wall was a map above her bookshelf, highlighting the indigenous peoples and languages of Alaska.
I have really tried to put more effort into saturating our environment with our native languages, and particularly the Inupiaq language. I am a second language learner of my heritage language. And I think that more we permeate the environment with it, the easier it will be to start hearing pieces of it, the easier it will be to remind ourselves that it is an attainable, approachable goal to get to the point where we can actually reclaim and use and understand our languages.
From an early age, Huntington was interested in learning about other cultures, and languages came easy to her, as did mathematics. Attending Mount Edgecombe as a student in the early 90s, Huntington began her path toward educational leadership. She remembers a project in her social studies class where they had to propose a community improvement project to their legislators, budget and all.
And it was really about empowerment. It was really about feeling the sense that we can work towards our own quality of life improvements. We can address the issues that we face without having to have somebody come in and teach us how or guide us through.
After graduating in 1994, Huntington moved back to Shishmaref because she wanted to continue her cultural education, learning how to sew and butcher while remotely attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Her second year, she split time between her home village and the Fairbanks campus and would eventually earn a bachelor's and master's degree in education. She taught kindergarten for 4.5 years at the Shishmaref School, and then high school math for another 4.5, and then she was promoted to assistant principal. She expected that it would be tough to supervise her colleagues, but she found that having a deeper knowledge of the community and the school was invaluable for the role.
But overall, the sentiment and the feedback I got was, Mary, it's so good to have somebody who just gets it. It's so good to have somebody who understands.
She worked there as assistant principal for 2 years before moving to Koyuk to be the principal. And then several years ago, a long-standing passion became central to her work when she was promoted to the coordinator of cultural programs for the Bering Strait School District. Culturally responsive education will be at the forefront of Huntington's work at Mount Edgecombe High School. She says it's usually misunderstood as cultural heritage or language courses, but for education to be truly culturally responsive, it goes beyond that.
Culturally responsive education includes teaching math in a way that allows a student to reach their full potential because you know enough about the student and their identity and their heritage and how that all fits in together. But I think being more visible and more intentional with our heritage and identity will allow us to be much more quickly successful with the academic content all across the board.
Huntington was hired by the State Board of Education earlier this month. She succeeds Janelle Vanoss, who's been named president of Alaska Pacific University. Mount Edgecombe academic principal Bernie Gurley also left after a 17-year career at the school. He'll be succeeded by Miranda Baca. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Wesley Early in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Claire Strempel in Juneau, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, or just to get in touch, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.